Hey, podcast listeners, it's Samir. I'm recording this voice memo from Florence, Italy. I'm actually here for my brother's wedding, so I won't be on the show this week. And this month actually is going to be a little bit different here on the Colin and Samir show. And that's because Colin's also getting married at the end of this month. So we're going to be trying out some new things here on the podcast feed. And I also wanted to tell you about an experiment we are doing on YouTube. We're doing a new spin on our show, Creator Support. It's a separate channel. If you were listening to the show last year, then you're familiar with this format, but we're trying a different spin on it. We uploaded a behind the scenes video there. So if you want to check that out, that's live on YouTube now. Just go to Creator Support. All right, Colin's taking over this week on the show. So I hope you guys enjoy.
Let's start with this. We do not intend to ban TikTok.
The U.S. House of Representatives has passed a bill that would ban TikTok in the U.S. unless its Chinese parent company sells the social media platform.
We support that bill. We welcome that bill. We do not see it as a ban, right? We see it as a divestment.
What it does in terms of allowing people to share information in a free way and a way that allows people to have discourse is very important. But we do have concerns.
Hey, podcast listeners, this is Colin. We have a special edition of the Colin and Samir Show today. And that's because we're joined by both writers from the published press. We have Nate back again.
What's up?
And we have Hannah. Hannah, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So today on the show, we are going to cover three stories that we've covered in the past in our newsletter. We're going to be starting with the TikTok ban, if I can even call it a ban. That's kind of up for debate. But first, Hannah, what are you doing in LA?
I'm sitting in Samir's seat because I'm visiting you guys from sunny Portland, Oregon, and I'm here to join Nate to go to the Information's Creator Summit.
So both of you were at the Information Summit, which is a creator economy conference. They have a bunch of speakers. From my experience, largely a lot of actually VCs and creator companies that attend the summit. I'm curious, from both of you, you were there yesterday, what was one thing that was interesting from the summit?
Yeah, I saw Ty Haney speak, and she is the founder of Outdoor Voices. As a proud doing things hat and short owner, it was really exciting to hear from her and to hear her be really transparent about the fall of Outdoor Voices and how what she said was that personality is like a single point of failure, and that happened to her. And even though she's not a pure play creator, I feel like that's really relatable for a lot of creators when building their businesses.
So we covered that in the newsletter. We put that quote in there that personality was a point of failure. And what she means by that is that she became the personality for the brand of Outdoor Voices. And then when she was essentially ousted from the company, the brand no longer has that community leader. And so she was giving that as kind of like a warning to creators who are starting brands, to make sure that you're not overly attached to the brand.
Yes. And that's the bet that she's taking with her new platform, TYB. It's all about creators and their communities and them working together to build a business. And that's what she thinks will be a strong foundation in a lasting creator company.
Yeah. And I thought her point about in the early days of Outdoor Voices, their success was really from hiking clubs. You know, it's just these really organic communities that they tied themselves to. And she brought up, like, looking around, you know, run clubs are becoming a huge thing. I know Venice Run Club, Colin, you ran in their mile race, did pretty well.
I mean, Nate, now that you've brought it up, yes, I ran in a race with Venice Run Club, and I ran a 6:16 mile.
Pretty impressive.
Thought I injured my lungs for the next 3 hours, but yeah, I finished 6:16.
Breaking news, Colin is an athlete. I think that's what he wants you to know.
That's what I want you to take away from this episode. So, Nate, for you, what did you take away from the Information Summit? What were people talking about?
Yeah, I think one quote that really stuck out to me was, specializing allows you to charge what you're worth. This came from Duke Moore, who's a full-time accountant and finance creator known as @DukeLovesTaxes online. I never heard of Duke before. I'd never seen, you know, any of his videos. So he's an accountant first and a finance creator second. And when he started posting TikToks that were taking off, he began receiving hundreds of DMs every day of people asking him for tax advice when tax season came around. And his accounting business didn't actually find solid footing, though, until he stopped trying to serve everyone and answer everyone's questions. And he instead specialized on creators with tax questions tied to their unique profession, because he had a lot in common with them, a lot of empathy with them. So obviously it's very relevant because tax day is coming up. Do your taxes. But yeah, I thought that was a really unique quote. Specializing allows you to charge what you're worth, that is applicable to so many different types of creators.
I definitely think that's a good perspective, whether your business is advertising or you're selling directly to your audience like he is, right? It's important, the more that you target your audience, the more that you know them really well, and it's a like-minded group of people, the more valuable that becomes to the right advertiser who really wants that specific group of people. Mm-hmm. So these two topics we actually covered on Wednesday, the day that we're recording right now, in the newsletter. And if you're unfamiliar with the way the newsletter works, in every send, we cover three stories. Now, that's essentially what we're going to get into right now. We're going to cover three stories similarly to how we actually do it in the newsletter. And the top story of this episode is the TikTok ban. This is something that we've dedicated 4 or 5 issues to in the last month and a half, really trying to track it and make sure people are up to speed with what's happening here. So we'll bring you up to speed, and then we're going to answer this question of, you know, how close are we to an actual TikTok ban? So Hannah, why don't you start us off and catch us up to speed a little bit with the TikTok ban as we reported on it first, March 13th.
Let's first clarify what the bill actually is. So the bill that the House passed intends to force ByteDance to sell TikTok within 6 months, not ban it outright, though it will have to be banned in the US if it fails to do so within 6 months.
So what we're talking about here is a divestment.
Correct.
Is that the right way to say that word, a divestment?
Divestment is divestment. What I thought. Yeah, okay. I thought it was divesting, yeah.
So a ban is potentially on the table, but the reality is the US government is looking more so to have TikTok sold to a US company.
Yes. So a lot of people have thrown their hat in the ring to buy TikTok. And when it comes to President Biden, he has said that he would sign the bill if it were to pass his desk. Then shortly after, Vice President Kamala Harris came forward and said they might not sign it if it did come their way.
I know President Trump has said he would not sign it because it would give too much power to Meta, is what he's saying.
I think it's all mixed up. I think the one thing that's worth clarifying, though, is that Kevin O'Leary, Mr. Wonderful from Shark Tank, has been a very vocal proponent of purchasing it himself. But a little known fact is that he's actually Canadian. So I don't know. The Canadians might be...
Interesting.
Yeah.
Saying you want to buy TikTok just feels like marketing for yourself at this point. At one point, I believe the D'Amelio family was trying to raise the funds to buy TikTok.
Oh, goodness.
Mark D'Amelio, he's everywhere.
Yeah, I think he was trying to buy it. So yeah, there's a lot of stories out there about it. I do think what's interesting when it comes to Biden is that, you know, he also has been posting on TikTok, or at least his campaign has been posting, because it is such an effective marketing tool and 150 million or so Americans use it. So it's sort of this interesting thing where we have this looming potential ban or divestment, and yet even the government itself
is using it
and finds it to be valuable and perhaps has changed their tone a little bit on whether they would ban it or not.
So Hannah, too, I know in terms of covering this whole ordeal with TikTok, you've actually spoken with some creators to get their point of view on, you know, potential sale, potential ban. What have they told you?
Yeah, I spoke with V of Under the Desk News. She's a TikTok news creator, and she was very much in support of standing with TikTok and fighting against the ban, not just because she is a TikTok creator, but she doesn't see it as a legitimate national security issue. She sees it as being against the Constitution with the First Amendment. And, you know, she told me that she will go down with the ship if it leaves. And I commend her for just, you know, being fully on board with that. Meanwhile, Adam Faes, who owns the short form media company Gymnasium, they have a bunch of shows on TikTok, on Instagram Reels. He said that him and his team were taking the TikTok ban very seriously, but that, you know, they would be okay if something did happen to it. You know, they would be okay posting just on Reels or YouTube Shorts and just finding other short form media outlets that they could still be present. It was very much a diversification play.
So where are we now in terms of this being an actual threat? Are we so far past the point of TikTok actually being banned? Like, because it feels to me like things have cooled off, right?
Which is interesting, because I think that's why this House bill feels like it came out of nowhere for a lot of people. Because I remember last year I was living in DC at the time, and I took the train over to Capitol Hill when the noise was really getting louder and TikTok was flying out creators to protest almost on Capitol Hill, talk about their small businesses and everything. And it doesn't feel like there's that same kind of momentum or like pushback almost in that way. It almost feels like people are just kind of ambivalent. I mean, bring up Adam Faes, right? And him talking about, you know, yeah, we're focused on diversifying. Like, that's the name of the game. I know Duke's Taxes was talking about that at the Information Summit yesterday. He said, there's a lot of opportunities out there. We're not scared. You can't depend on one thing. Just in regards to talking about how, you know, the social media industry works in general, right? But at the same time, I think that ambivalence and that idea of people almost forgetting that, you know, a TikTok ban might happen. Pew Research actually put out a study today that said in fall 2023, support for a US TikTok ban has declined. So around this time last year, March 2023, 50% of US adults said they would support the US government banning TikTok versus now that number is at 38. So it's been interesting seeing that decline. And I wonder if it's just because it's been in the news a lot less until now.
There's something interesting that I know we all read in Time magazine today. The title is "The House TikTok Ban is an Empty Threat." And I think some of the reason that people may be less in favor of the ban than maybe a year before has to do with information like this that has come out. And I'll read it to you. But it reads, the government must show that the ban furthers an important government interest unrelated to speech and does not burden significantly more speech than necessary to further that interest. To paraphrase the Supreme Court, Congress launches a missile to kill a mouse. It's possible that some TikTok user data has intelligence value to the Chinese Communist Party, but the overwhelming majority of TikTok users and videos pose absolutely no threat to national security. And it goes on to read, if TikTok is reasonably certain the ban is unconstitutional, it does not need to take the drastic step of divestiture to avoid it. So I think that some of it is that a lot of us Americans are on TikTok. We're posting, we're consuming.
170 million.
170 million?
Yeah.
So that's a lot of Americans who are on TikTok scrolling, probably looking at a lot of this content and having a hard time seeing how this is valuable data to the Chinese Communist Party. And of course, I'm sure there is data there and there are ways to use it for harm. But from a consumer standpoint, when we're looking at, you know, essentially like memes and travel guides and cooking tutorials and everything that's on TikTok, our everyday experience with it is that it's giving us joy, it's making us laugh, it's connecting us with friends. And it's hard to sort of shift modes into, oh, this is a threat to national security.
Yeah, and I know on March 27th, we wrote in the press how a group of bipartisan senators actually called to declassify TikTok-related briefings. They said that concerns raised by the intelligence community should be shared more broadly to better educate the public as to why TikTok poses a national security threat. Because I think, to your point, the majority of people, the content they are watching, by no means the two ideas of TikTok is dangerous to this thing I'm watching of a penguin dancing, you know, to the new Beyonce song, right? Like,
yeah.
Those ideas feel so far away. And I think also to your point, you know, in terms of people at TikTok itself, a friend's sister actually works at TikTok. And they said the mindset has kind of just been like, just keep swimming, in the sense of, you know, they've been dealing with talk of a TikTok ban for 4 years now. And it's almost just like background chatter at this point. Mm. It's like, you have to ignore that in order to show up to your job and do your job every day. And I almost think there's a parallel between that and the average TikTok user, you know, in terms of my day-to-day is already so busy. I have so much, only so much I can think about, only so many, you know, political matters, let's say, I can get behind. Like, how much do I really want to think about getting rid of this thing that does bring me joy or information on the day-to-day?
And meanwhile, they keep on rolling out new features. They just rolled out a new monetization feature that lets creators earn money from search results. And they have a TikTok Youth Council that they just announced that is between the ages of 15 and 18. These kids kind of informing them of like what is safe for the platform. So they keep on trekking along with all these new updates.
So TikTok and TikTokers are basically just Finding Nemo. is what you're telling me.
That there was a Finding Nemo reference.
I just want to make sure.
I was going to like assume the majority of the listenership, it's like yeah. they would get that and be a fun, you know, like little Easter egg. But thanks for well, putting it.
I just want, you know, look, I caught the reference, everybody.
I appreciate it.
So, all right. So moving on, let's head to our second story. Hannah, what's the second story?
Our second story is on kids creator Ryan's World. He has over 36 million subscribers on YouTube. He came to fame making toy unboxing videos. And he's got a live action and cartoon movie in this film, Ryan's World, the movie. He's working with media studio Pocket Watch, and they're self-distributing the film. They're shopping it around to around 2,000 theaters.
Okay, so for reference, Ryan is a 12-year-old. With 36 million subscribers and a long history already on YouTube. Samir and I have talked about him on the channel before. You know, kids' YouTube is an incredible opportunity because there are a lot of children watching YouTube and they have the most available time to consume content. Not only that, I don't know if you have nieces and nephews, but my nieces and nephews, I'll sit with them. They'll watch the same video over and over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. They watch children's YouTube videos as if it's like your favorite song. So there is a lot of opportunity for people who make kids content on YouTube to get to viewership levels that are like unheard of, you know, in the hundreds of millions. So Ryan is a legend in that space and is now with his family and with his company, really the whole organization, launching this movie and trying to self-distribute.
And really betting on his audience because Cocomelon is coming out with a movie with Universal. Yeah. Mm. So I think it's a really interesting like competition there to see who's going to get kind of more distribution through those two avenues.
So one having the backing of a major studio and one going at it a little bit more independently reminds me of, you know, our friends at Yes Theory with their Project Iceman documentary and deciding to self-fund it to raise money from their audience and do a run through the theaters as well, but entirely independently.
Yeah, I talked to Yes Theory's head of operations, Pedro Peva, and they partnered with Cinemark, and they did a smaller run. They did around 200 theaters. But he was saying that self-distribution can be a narrative asset. He told me, if you find a way to do it and nobody let you in, that also strengthens the brand and even strengthens the story of the movie itself.
I think that's really important. It's not only that creators are making feature-length movies, it's the story of getting the movie in theaters that people can kind of wrap their heads around. I think for fans of Ryan's World, it's a little bit of a different experience if they know it's independent. And, you know, of course, these are kids, but I would say if the parents of the kids are invested in Ryan's World and they know that, there's this element of like, oh, we actually want to come out to the theaters and support because it's not a big studio film.
I even think if you look at Rocka Rocka with Talk To Me, right? Obviously, they produced that, distributed it with A24. But, you know, even though they've kind of gotten to a point where they're post-platform in a sense, they don't really regularly upload on YouTube. They were along the way telling the story of how they even got to the point where they could make Talk To Me on their YouTube channel and keeping their core audience they developed over, you know, 10 plus years engaged with the story. So I think that idea of telling the story behind the story is, it almost feels like so natural or ingrained to YouTube itself, you know, just keeping the community updated and along the journey with you.
I think making feature-length films too offers this really unique opportunity for the audience to have an event, to come out to something, to do something that is different than the regularly scheduled programming on YouTube that they'll really remember. And it's this unique opportunity to scale. You know, when you look at Yes Theory with Project Iceman, they're not the main character of the movie. Anders is the guy who putting himself through this incredible athletic feat of doing an Ironman in Antarctica. That's in a way scaling themselves because they're not the ones doing this Ironman in Antarctica. Now with Ryan's World, it goes even a step further because right now it's live action and animated, but the next one could be fully animated. And that could open up the doors for, you know, years and years worth of films that are animated just like any other sort of Pixar movie or children's movie we're used to. And Ryan and his company now have this opportunity to build IP that can live on, right? And they've already done it because they do have animated channels, but taking it a step further and bringing it into films if they find that this is successful could be a huge opportunity so that, you know, Ryan, who's 12 years old right now, I would imagine by the time he turns 15 and 16, he's not as interested in being Ryan from Ryan's World, right?
Yeah.
So this, in my opinion, is the big opportunity for the company to live far into the future is by slowly transitioning the brand into this animated version of him.
Yeah. Another thing Pedro pointed out when we were chatting was just by virtue of being in a children's genre, you have this mass appeal and this group appeal from a theater of a mom who wants to give herself some peace for 2 hours and just entertain her children. Versus something like Project Iceman, where you might need to have some prior knowledge about it to really want to go see it. With a movie like Ryan's World, you recognize him from a YouTube channel, and it just has mass appeal for any type of kid, no matter what background you have.
So you're saying the plot is not as important here.
Yes.
It's more so the opportunity as a parent to take a break.
Uh-huh.
I get it. Okay. Moving on, the final story. What do we got?
Yeah, so we covered YouTube Shorts monetization. It turned 1 year old recently. And basically, YouTube came out with a bunch of statistics, just really catching us up to speed on how Shorts monetization has played out with creators. I think the stat that stuck out the most was that 80% of creators who joined the YouTube Partner Program through Shorts eligibility now make money through other YouTube features. So think whether it's long-form advertising, memberships, or Brand Connect. One creator I spoke to who's a sports commentator, Andrew Fenichel, he connected his external merch store through YouTube Shopping tool last August. And basically just by linking apparel links to his shorts, he's driven 5 million product impressions and 10,000 product clicks. And that's all passive. You know, that was something that really stuck out to him. He was very much like, I don't have to be screaming at my followers every day like, hey, I'm wearing this hat, go buy it, go buy it. It's just the YouTube Shopping tool automatically linking that into all of his shorts. And for him, as someone who works a full-time job, who only has so much time every day to work on videos and therefore chooses to focus on shorts, that kind of revenue stream, you know, linking those products, that's a real difference maker. He had this quote, you know, being able to monetize shorts has made this feel like a legitimate career path. And I thought that really stuck out.
Yeah, I think that statistic around it being an on-ramp to other avenues of monetization is what's really important. And that's what Samir and I thought was the promise of shorts when it was introduced. You know, we were pretty confident that shorts monetization would never, of course, rival long form. But we thought that the interesting thing here is that it's this lower barrier to entry. And it's this offering that can either bring people who are pre-existing on TikTok or Reels over to YouTube for the first time, or it can bring, you know, early aspiring first-time creators. And you can become part of the YouTube Partner Program and start to become comfortable and learn about what it means to make actual money through making videos. And that's really impactful. You know, the fact that you can come in the door through YouTube Shorts, you can become part of the YouTube Partner Program, and then you're just aware of this ecosystem, right? And you're like, let's start making long-form videos. Let's attach my shopping links here and start to grow as a creator. I think that's the big win for YouTube Shorts, the on-ramp aspect of it. Not necessarily, you know, creators posting, wow, look how much money I made on Shorts. You know, that is not a huge reality. That's not something we're seeing every day. And we may never see that type of thing, right? Like, I think we don't see that on TikTok. We don't see that on Reels. Short form content is just harder to monetize.
Yeah. So since Samir's not here, Colin, I have to fill the obligatory role of mentioning LinkedIn. But I posted this story on LinkedIn and I got a comment that I found really interesting. And I'm curious to hear from you how this plays into how you and Samir, you know, approach shorts.
So you're just plugging your LinkedIn is what's happening here.
No, I actually thought this was a legitimately interesting comment, but someone wrote, I have no problem with shorts other than the time constraint. I feel people's best work is created without any restraints. But that said, restraints can make for an interesting challenge. So shrug emoji. Basically what they're saying is by restraining your creativity to making a up to 60 second short, it can actually allow you to not only forces you to make the thing, you know, you're able to make more things versus, let's say, getting stuck in the trap of working on a long form video that ends up taking you 3 or 4 months to produce.
So the only problem this person has with shorts is the time restraint, but at the same time, it's the thing they like about shorts?
Yes.
Okay. All I have to say to that is, you know, if you have a problem with the time constraint, luckily you're on YouTube and there are many ways to blow past that time constraint. But I agree that because of the length and because of the format, it does feel manageable. And there are windows of time that Samir and I have available where we are able to make a short. And we would not, of course, be able to make a long form piece of content, right? We have more time available than if we were just going to post a tweet or an Instagram carousel. It's like this unique amount of time. If we have 2 to 3 hours blocked, it's like, let's, we could probably write, shoot, and edit a short in that time frame. And we're making something that could result in millions and millions of impressions for our brand. And because, you know, we're creating something in that small window, yeah, those constraints are good. You can end up really surprising yourself and making something that you're really proud of. You know, for us, Samir and I have started to actually take another look at shorts. We sort of took a break from shorts for a while. And after spending time with Mark Rober recently, who has been incredibly invigorated by shorts, it kind of rubbed off on us. And we started to, you know, come back to the drawing board. And now we've put out a couple of shorts just in the past week and will continue to do so. I think for a while, Samir and I felt like we were almost using shorts to find new audience, to reach a certain level of subscribers, because it's an effective way to do that. And then when we hit 1 million subscribers, we were like, growing new audience is not what's important right now. Let's focus on the production process. Let's focus on, you know, the current audience that we do have. And now, after sort of taking a pause on that, are reinvigorated, more interested in making shorts and seeing if we can push the bounds of our audience again, start to grow.
Yeah, I think my reaction too, when I read that quote and kind of off of your comment, is on the one hand, you know, this idea of no constraints, creating a long form video, there's just so much opportunity to do really creative things, right? But on the other hand, sometimes you might get down this rabbit hole, this pursuit of perfection that can actually paralyze you from creating the thing. And it's almost interesting that shorts offers those constraints of it has to be short, it has to be vertical. So yeah, I don't know. I feel like a lot of people are going to really be weighing this balance of shorts and long form moving forward. But at the end of the day, it seems like shorts AdSense for the majority of people is not going to be the real path towards a sustainable career.
Yeah. And who knows? They, you know, YouTube and TikTok and Reels could prove me wrong that there is a model here to make really significant income just from the platform on short form vertical content. But yeah, as I see it, the most valuable thing is that it is an on-ramp to either other forms of monetization, or it's an on-ramp to just understanding what this career is, sort of like dipping your toe in and seeing if this is something you want to do if you're passionate about. All right. And before we wrap up on this shorts topic, Nate, I can tell you're itching. You've got one more thing you want to say.
Look, I mentioned that I talked to my friend Andrew, and I mean, I know just from talking about him and his career goals, right? He started really posting on shorts. He is a fan of YouTube. He's been uploading videos on YouTube since he was in high school. But also, it's just not only an opportunity to maybe sell merch and create a creator business, but also a path towards a career in traditional broadcasting. You know, I know his ultimate dream is to be a Stephen A. Smith type of ESPN broadcaster. And I think that's something that sometimes gets left out of the narrative. You know, some people use shorts as an opportunity to broadcast themselves, to get their skill sets out into the world.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Talent discovery is a huge part of this. You know, it was a part of it when Samir and I were starting out strictly with long form content, when their shorts didn't even exist. A lot of, you know, when we were getting 5,000 views, 10,000 views, a lot of the inbound we were getting was not about advertising. It was about, you know, hey, I like the style of hosting you guys do. I like the style of storytelling. Would you come do this for us and our brand? And so, yeah, I think that's a great point. You know, with short form, it's like a talent show, right? It's like the algorithms find exactly what you want and it shows you things you've never seen before. And a lot of people on the other end are, you know, looking for talent, looking for people to help them. So, yeah, I think that's a great point.
Every video is an opportunity to prove yourself.
Is that from your LinkedIn?
No, it's from Wesley Wang, who I interviewed for the published press. He made a great point about that. God,
it really
damn
felt
it.
Like it was from your LinkedIn. Yeah. All right. Well, those were our three stories. And like I said earlier, in the published press, which we send 3 times a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, we cover three stories every time. So we went long on those stories. You can get them in a much more condensed version in the published press, in the newsletter written by Nate and Hannah. And you can get a lot of this information first. So if you don't subscribe to the published press, we'll put a link in the description of this episode.
Publishpress.com.
Subscribe.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having us.